Hello and welcome to the Cottage Punk Podcast. Today's May 8th, and this is Hot Off the Press. I'm your co-host, Andrea Ristjord.
And I'm Andrew Pillamy. And this is the podcast where we provide news on the arts, sciences, and humanities. And today I'm going to start off by talking about what's happening in Hawaii and Mount Kilauea. And then I'm also going to talk about Snowball Earth and the new findings we have about that hypothesis.
I'm going to cover evidence of early hominin activity in the Philippines that pushes back the original date of colonization, or the previously thought date. And I'm going to talk about size-based extinction and how it's related to early humans.
Sounds like a lot of exciting stuff. To start things off, I want to talk about Mount Kilauea. If any of you have been listening to the news lately, there's been huge lava flows on the large island in Hawaii. And all of this is coming from Mount Kilauea, which has been one of the five most active volcanoes in Hawaii. So to give a bit of a background of how Hawaii was made and why Hawaii is so volcanic, Hawaii is somewhat unique because Hawaii is formed from a magma plume that's deep underneath the Earth's crust and actually in the Earth's mantle. And the magma that's rising from that point is so hot that it manages to break through the crust and produce these massive volcanic islands. And if you look at Hawaii on a map of the Pacific Ocean, you can kind of see that it makes a line of islands. And the reason why there's a line of islands is because that magma plume has stayed stationary while the tectonic plate above it has moved, allowing for almost a dripping of islands on the plate above it.
So like in reverse, if you had a candle that you were dripping wax and slowly moved it across a table?
Exactly.
That's cool.
Yeah. So that's why we have the Hawaiian Islands. And Mount Kilauea just happens to be on the youngest of those islands.
So right now it's over the plume?
Correct. Yep, the plume is on that largest island. And actually, all of those smaller islands used to be around the same size, but they're far older than the largest island. So they've weathered down to these smaller, more intricate and really playful topography.
Is that because of like wave activity and weather, or is it because they're sinking?
Yeah, so it's the natural process and it's the natural cycle of most magma plume islands in the Pacific Ocean. You can usually tell how old an island is by how weathered down it is. Mm. And this applies for all sorts of landscapes and landforms in geology. So like if we look at the mountains on the east coast and the Appalachian Mountains, they're kind of rolling hills and there's a lot of weathering that's happened. Mm-hmm. And we can tell that those mountains must be older than the ones we see being formed in the Himalaya, where they're really jagged edged and they look really fresh. There's like all of those exposed rock faces that look like they're just
very freshly angular. There.
Exactly. So what exactly is Kilauea? Because it doesn't look like other volcanoes. It doesn't look like Mount St. Helens, and it definitely doesn't look like what Pompeii was. And that's because there's three different types of volcano. There's rhyolitic, there's andesitic, and then there's basaltic. And the volcano that is Kilauea happens to be a basaltic volcano. And basaltic volcanoes are often coined as shield volcanoes because they're really shallow slopes. And when you're on it, you don't even really notice that you're on a mountain of any sort. Versus Mount St. Helens, that's really steep and is like very evidently a mountain. And the reason it has the shape it does is because of the magma that makes it. So shield volcanoes are made out of basaltic magma.
What does that mean? Basaltic? So that's also a kind of rock, isn't it?
It is. It's the exact same kind of rock that you would see at the bottom of the ocean. So where we have these massive rifting zones in the ocean, where new rock is being formed, it's the same, or not necessarily the same, but very similar chemical structure as Kilauea and the Hawaiian Islands. And the reason for that is because the crust at those regions is much thinner, so the crust isn't able to necessarily extract or concentrate that magma, so the silicon content in it is much higher. And because of that high silica content, its viscosity is much lower. And a low viscosity means that it's super runny magma. And that super runny magma isn't able to build up as much pressure as a rhyolitic volcano or an andesitic volcano.
So what are the differences between those three types of volcanoes?
So, and I actually need to just clarify myself right now, because rhyolitic and andesitic volcanoes are high in silica, and the basaltic volcanoes are the ones that are low in silica. And when you have that increase in silica, the magma has more resistance, so it's able to build up more. And rhyolitic and andesitic volcanoes are those high silica, high viscosity volcanoes, and they're the ones that erupt with a huge explosion, and those are the ones that cause the massive ash plumes, and those are the ones that people most iconically think of as being volcanoes.
Those are the ones that we were talking last week about, how ash clouds, evidence of volcanoes, can show up in sediment cores.
Yeah, so all three types of volcanoes can show up in sediment cores, but that study was specifically looking at andesitic volcanoes. And again, rhyolitic, andesitic, and basaltic, all they're really talking about is the minerals that are found and the type of magma that forms them. Now, volcano explosions are cool. Everyone loves looking at them. Everyone loves watching them. And some of them are less common than others. For example, there are things such as phreatic explosions, which are highly explosive. These are some of the most volatile explosions we can have. And that's from when magma will hit groundwater and it turns all of that groundwater into steam.
Oh,
and essentially
man.
Blasts the whole thing.
So like that magma will touch groundwater and then that can explode out of the ground and shoot rock everywhere?
Somewhat like a geyser. I would say a geyser is in a similar field where it's groundwater that's being heated up into steam. And then that pressure that builds up has to be released in some way. And then I like this eruption just because it has a really funny name. It's called Strombolian eruption.
Ooh, Strombolis are delicious.
Yeah. And it's literally called that because the lava that it forms and the rock that it forms ends up making a texture that looks a lot like Stromboli, where it's very layered and rolled.
That's such an interesting interconnection of cultures, where you have something like Stromboli, which is Italian and is a very specific type of food. It says something about the type of people that are doing this study on the rocks.
It definitely does. And Strombolian eruptions are what creates the classic cinder cone volcano that you usually see in Jurassic Park and stuff. And that's actually the type of volcano that Pompeii was. And it makes total sense.
No longer.
Yeah.
So what's going on in Hawaii then?
So what's happening in Hawaii is there's a series of faults, and along those faults we're seeing rifting. So what's happening is these two land masses are sort of splitting and separating, and there was some recent earthquakes in Hawaii that sort of triggered a really abrupt event of lava flow and eruption. And this has actually been going on since the mid-80s. It's been an active volcano for quite a while. It's just that as of late, there's been a lot of lava flow.
And that's all the videos you're seeing online now of lava creeping over roads and into people's houses and consuming cars and stuff.
All that fresh rock. Beautiful stuff.
Birth of an Earth.
Birth of an Earth. All right, so what's your first topic?
So first I want to talk about evidence of early human activity or early human relatives activity and colonization of the Philippines. So
very cool.
About 60 years ago, stone tools and evidence of Homo erectus colonization was found in the Wallacea region. Wallacea? I don't know how to pronounce that. Wallacea. I'm going to go with Wallacea. W-A-L-L-A-C-E-A. Region of what is now Indonesia.
Gotcha.
So this is a group of islands between New Guinea and Borneo.
Very cool.
So north of Australia, yeah. South of the Philippines. And so 60 years ago, they found evidence of Homo erectus colonization, stone tools, etc. And that was the oldest date of habitation by archaic humans, basically, in that
region.
Holy
crap.
But just recently, Nature published a study that is from a dig, an excavation at Kalinga, which is in the northern region of Luzon, which is the largest northern island in the Philippines. And at this site, they found 57 stone tools and the skeleton of a prehistoric rhino that has evidence of butchery found on it. So
whoa.
That means that, yeah, it's pretty cool. That means that there's huge mammal bones that have cutting marks on them and pounding marks on them. So that means the people were, the cutting marks come from getting the meat off, and the pounding comes from getting the marrow out.
So they've been seen by a butcher, is what you're saying.
Right. It's not just that the animal was
attacked by a,
it wasn't consumed by other animals, it was consumed by humans.
That's a cool find.
Yeah. And the bed that this was found in was a very clay rich bed, and they took samples from the rhino teeth and some of the other bones of other animals found in that same bed. So they had freshwater turtles and a type of deer native to the Philippines. And they dated them to 777,000 to 631,000 years old.
That's crazy old.
Yeah, that's also like hundreds of thousands of years older than what was previously thought as the oldest human, early human habitation.
So if I recall correctly from studying the Lapita people, I think it was previously understood humans didn't occupy this area until like 100,000 years ago.
False.
So 600 is 700,000 years ago?
Yeah.
I'm curious what that says about the populations we see in Polynesia and how early they may have gotten there.
I don't know.
If this migration occurred hundreds of thousands of years earlier.
Yeah, it all comes down to what evidence do we have in the fossil record, really. Because the study that was done 60 years ago that put the date at around 66,000 years old was from a toe bone that just happened to be found.
Wow, so that's just, a lucky
it just
find.
Depends on, yeah, it just depends on luck, really. But the cool thing about this new find, aside from that it makes a claim that early hominins were in that region hundreds of thousands of years earlier than thought, was that there's a chance that the Philippines played a larger role in the migration south into what's now Indonesia and what's now Australia.
Ah, I see.
So not only did people live in that area earlier than thought, it means that even if the 66,000-year-old toe bone, even if that person was not a relative of the rhino eaters,
yeah,
that means that there is more than one wave of people coming through instead of just one wave of people coming through.
So it's almost like it's a multi-phase migration. We're not just talking about one group or like one family that's coming through at a specific time, but like multiple waves of
migration through there.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it is cool.
Okay, so I think that's the end of our first two topics. You and I are going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll get on to our final two topics.
Stay on the line.
Yeah, stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to the Cottage Punk Podcast. Thank you for sticking around during the break. And to start things off, I think we're going to have Andrea with her next topic.
So my next topic is about size-based extinction and how it's related to early human activity.
Neato. So give us a quick rundown as to what size-based extinction is.
So size-based extinction, it's a tongue twister.
Yeah, definitely that.
But it's also when animals that are large, go extinct faster than their smaller counterparts. So like woolly mammoths right. are not around anymore, but we still have elephants.
Yeah. Or like saber-toothed tigers and mm-hmm. like the Siberian tiger.
Yeah.
So in my classes, we were always sort of taught it's because they just weren't evolutionarily fit enough to last this long. And like things about oxygen not being high enough or something. What is it that you've heard?
So what I remember from school as well is that the climate wasn't right for them. So maybe yeah. there was a climate catastrophe or a large event having to do with the climate that kind of wiped them out. And maybe that has to do with what you were taught about how there weren't the right resources for them anymore. So that's kind of what both of us knew previously before coming into this topic. But what we're finding now, based on a study that was published in the journal Science, is that near human relatives may have contributed more to the decline and eventual extinction of these large animals than climate change did. And that's because of hunting.
So it's far more human influence than we previously thought.
According to the study, yes.
Ah, okay.
So what they're saying is that not until humans entered the picture did large-sized animals mean a greater risk of extinction. So if you think about early Earth, and there's all kinds of animals yeah. going around, humans aren't around yet. What are the biggest predators? The largest animals, probably. Larger animals have a higher percentage of survival than smaller animals. But once humans come on the scene, larger animals are more desirable to kill as prey because instead of killing a rabbit that will feed your family for a night, you can kill a mammoth that will feed your whole village.
So it's
a greater gain for the amount right. of effort you put into the hunting.
And humans not being necessarily the biggest of mammals was able to use tools, I'm guessing, to outcompete these larger mammals?
Pretty much. So what's interesting is that if you think about our first episode, we talk about human migration out of Africa. I talk about yeah. human migration a lot. But in our first episode, we talked about human migration out of Africa. So let's go back and think about that time period. So 125,000 years ago in Africa, humans were already living there. And we know that on larger land masses, the size of mammals is greater because of the larger land yeah. mass. But in Africa at that time, the largest land mammals were 50% smaller than land mammals on other continents.
Wow.
And we think that that is because of human occupation, basically.
That's wild.
In Africa. Yeah. So
literally, I guess.
Yes, literally. So you see that size-based extinction sort of already starting around 125,000 years ago. So at that time, the average African mammal was 50% smaller than those on other continents.
Mm-hmm.
And as humans migrated out of Africa, the size-based extinction phenomenon kind of followed them.
Ah, I see.
So you get humans migrating to, let's say, Area A.
Area A.
And then if you look at the timeline, the size-based extinction follows them. So it's the same location and the same time frame.
Gotcha. So there's a correlation occurring between regions having an introduction of humans and mm-hmm. then having a reduction in the size of the mammals present.
Correct. So this is like a huge trend, obviously. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of really large mammals around anymore. If you think about the largest animals or largest mammals that we know of now are either extinct or kept in conservatories.
Yeah.
Think about the African elephant, the Indian elephant. Think about large cats are almost all endangered now.
And we just recently had the extinction of a specific species of rhino, correct?
The white rhino, yeah, the last, well, not extinct, but the last male white rhino in Sudan died in the past few months,
which is
not the extinction of that species, but without another male counterpart, you can't reproduce anymore. So there's still some alive, but they're not going to continue,
so
which is very sad.
What does this project for the future? What's the outcome of this research?
So if you look at the projected like percentage decrease in size of animals, if we continue on this path in 200 years, the largest land mammal is going to be the domestic cow.
Holy crap.
Yeah, that's really small.
That's not big at all.
Yeah, it's because humans are a virus and we're taking over.
And that's specifically just land mammals, correct? So that doesn't include blue whales and killer whales and things like that.
Yeah, so this study doesn't talk about mammals that are in the ocean.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what the impact percentages and rates are for that. I think that they're very different because 95% of the oceans are unexplored.
Yeah, so at least for North America, that would mean the extinction of things like the bison, mm-hmm. moose, mm-hmm. elk. Mm-hmm. Well, that's
large
a frightening
cats.
Thought.
Think about like mountain lions and things like that.
That's not exactly an ideal future.
No, it's not. But we're on our way. If you think about how many things are endangered and how many things have to be protected by being on conservated or conservatory land or something.
It certainly needs to be constantly on our radar.
Yeah.
So for my next topic, I'm going to talk about something I found really interesting in university. And this is the snowball earth theory.
That always just makes me think of that. that cartoon of the comedian. Oh my gosh,
the
really
cartoon of the comedian.
I can't remember the guy who says, "I am the moon."
Oh my goodness, the Mighty Boosh.
The Mighty Boosh. It makes me think of the Mighty Boosh, where he's dressed up like the moon, but it could be like snowball.
Just
like
a massive
snowball.
Whipped cream snowball.
Yeah.
Well, it's not quite that. It's not talking about an Earth with a face necessarily. But there's research that just came out that is also arguing a long-standing hypothesis similar to your previous topic.
Mm-hmm.
So just as a rundown about what snowball Earth is, the snowball Earth is a hypothesis that the Earth was once entirely covered in ice. Some other versions of this are like the slush ball Earth, where it's not necessarily covered in ice, but maybe seasonally it's kind of slushy of some sort. But this was predicted to happen somewhere around 650 million years ago. We know this because there are sediments that are only possible to be made from glaciation, and they exist in bedrocks that were formed around the equator during that time.
Whoa.
Yeah. And the name snowball Earth was coined by Joseph Kirschvick, who discovered these banded iron formations around the globe that also correlated with this snowball Earth event.
That's BIF, right?
Yep. The term BIF simply is just an acronym for banded iron formation.
And that shows up as like striated rock, basically, right?
Yeah, and almost often it's like a purplish red. And it's always got these really cool banded laminations to it.
Cool.
Now, this event occurred right before the Cambrian explosion. And a lot of people have theorized or hypothesized that this may have triggered the explosion, the Cambrian explosion itself.
What is the Cambrian explosion?
So the Cambrian explosion happened around 500 million years ago, and it's this sudden burst in biologic diversity. Mm-hmm. So for a long time, we only have sort of a few categorized species and families of organisms. Mm-hmm. And then during the Cambrian explosion, we see this massive plume, this like huge burst of diversity.
So it's like, if you think about a yearly season cycle, it's like being in winter and then spring shows up and you have a billion insects being hatched and all of these animals coming out of hibernation, but except for instead of coming out of hibernation and hatching, they're like actually coming into existence.
Yeah, exactly that. Now, here's where the recent study is arguing points about Snowball Earth. Mm. Previously, it was thought that Snowball Earth was initiated or triggered by an event called the Great Oxygenation Event. Now, during the Great Oxygenation Event, there were all of these organisms that were using the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and converting it to oxygen, mm-hmm. similar to modern day trees. And that caused a surplus of oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. Now, that is what previously was understood to have caused the Snowball Earth. However, recent studies have come out that suggest that the earliest signs of tectonic activity may have been what triggered the Snowball Earth. Because the Earth is the only planet in our solar system that actually has active tectonic plates. Mm-hmm. And around 700 million years ago, we see the first signs of tectonic activity actually occurring.
So I always associate tectonic activity with volcanoes, like we were talking about earlier, and heat.
Yeah.
So how would tectonic like activity trigger Snowball Earth if it's kind of the opposite of volcanic activity?
So it may have been that this tectonic activity caused volcanoes to shoot off these plumes of ash, mm-hmm. and that this ash initially caused an albedo effect. So an albedo effect is where incoming solar rays are bounced back into the greater out space, mm. rather than being absorbed by the Earth's atmosphere.
So they were just providing like a shield from the sun, which is where we experience most of our heat coming from.
Yeah. And it's also believed and accepted that the reason why Snowball Earth stopped, rather than just being a constant positive feedback and persisting until today, mm-hmm. is that those same volcanoes increased the amount of CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere and allowed greenhouse gases to warm us up to the point where the ice started retreating away from the equator. Mm. Yeah. So that's the Snowball Earth, and this group from the University of Texas are making waves in the paleoclimate community. And I think that's all I've got to say for my two topics. Do you have any final words?
Nope.
Awesome. Well, thank you everyone for listening to the Cottage Punk podcast. This has been Andrew Pillamai
and Andrea Ristro.
And we'll be back to tell you more next week.